So I would like to talk about membrane fusion mechanism and how I'll try to give some historical perspective, because when I was doing this, I was in physics department with two other physicists who knew nothing about membranes, really. I mean, we knew something about polymers. Definitely, we didn't know anything about fusion, but we decided to work on it anyway, because we read somewhere, probably in science, that it's an important problem. We decided to see whether we can do something about it and try to understand it. So I don't need to go through the what is the membrane, and I mean, all these pictures are probably not totally correct. And even though I present here this standard picture of membrane, which has lots of junk in it, all these transmembrane proteins or other stuff, which is apparently very important for biology, we'll concentrate on modeling very simple membranes, which are just made of pure lipids or lipid mixtures, and see whether we can understand just that, even simpler system. So why membrane fusion is important? First and probably most important is that cell trafficking relies heavily on membrane fusion. And so, for example, you can imagine that when cells have to exchange some material with the outside, you can imagine the vesicle comes in, fuses with the cell membrane, and dumps its content into the cell. Or the same can happen vice versa, when the vesicle comes from within the cell to the surface of the cell and gets rid of some junk, for example, through exocytosis. And within the cell, different pieces like Golgi apparatus and the plasmatic reticulum can exchange lipids or some other molecules by just transporting them in vesicles. And this is definitely a much more effective way of transporting stuff. Imagine that you want to transport some stuff from this part of the cell to that part of the cell just by diffusion. So you just dump some important molecules here and wait till they reach here. Well, obviously, you'll lose most of the molecules somewhere in between, and they'll probably get chewed up by the protective mechanism of the cell. So it's much better to enclose them into vesicles, which have obvious protective properties for the internal part, and transport these vesicles via directed transport with some motors, maybe, or even simple diffusion. So cell trafficking is important. And I just one particular mechanism of trafficking is exocytosis, as I said, and it's very important in synaptic release when synaptic vesicles release neurotransmitters, and that's how our nervous system works, roughly. Viral entry also relies sometimes on membrane fusion, and definitely when you have viruses which are enveloped viruses, so the virus consists not just of the viral particle itself, but it's enveloped in the lipid membrane. When it enters the cell, it gets enveloped in another membrane, which is the part of the cell itself. And then this double sac actually can travel towards the nucleus of the cell and only then release the internal of the virus. So this way, virus actually can travel all the way through the cell without getting chewed up by the protective mechanisms again, because it gets covered by the cell membrane, by the membrane of the cell it's entering. So it's kind of, it looks to the cell that it's just part of its own. Drug delivery, again, it's very similar to viral entry, and you can deliver, hopefully you can deliver drugs in liposomes, or you can even deliver them in viral particles. So it would be very interesting to understand the fusion process, because obviously, even though you can deliver some liposome into the cell, and maybe even into the nucleus, you still have to release the drug. So somehow you have to trigger the fusion mechanism or the rupture mechanism. And understanding this fusion mechanism is very important, obviously. So what do we know about fusion? This is what we learned by reading papers at the time we started working on this problem, and by talking to our friends in experiments. So we learned that it happens on short time scales, microseconds. So it's short on our human time scale, but it's definitely much faster than any molecular motion time scale. It happens on small length scale, and here I mean small, because it happens really on nanometer length scale, which is the thickness of membrane. Well, there was no direct observation of intermediates so far because it's quite a fast process happening on a small time scale, and there are no good experimental techniques to freeze transition complexes that would show what's the mechanism of fusion. So there is no direct evidence of the mechanism, of how this mechanism goes on. There is a bunch of indirect evidence, which relies on the effect of lipid composition on the rate of fusion, effect of mechanical or electrical stress on membrane, and membrane on the fusion process, and, for example, temperature. And by using this indirect evidence, one can see whether a given mechanism actually agrees with experimental observations. So the main point is that the microscopic mechanism is not well understood, and we have to come up with a simple and reliable model trying to describe it. So first of all, as I mentioned, the membrane is in the cell is not really a pure lipid membrane. There's lots of proteins floating around, and they're definitely, from the biological point of view, we know that these proteins regulate fusion, so they are necessary. If you don't have proteins, fusion will go sometimes, but it will go in much less controlled fashion. When you add appropriate proteins, they can control the fusion process very well. So it is conceivable that fusion proteins are really necessary when you're trying to model the fusion process. But we were still believing in the fact that many things in nature are quite universal and not very specific. And by that, we mean that even though the proteins are necessary for the fusion process to occur, for example, they have to bring two cells in close contact to each other, or they have to bring the synaptic vesicle close to the cell membrane, but then they stay away from the fusion zone. And everything that happens after that is really controlled by the lipids themselves. And that simplifies the model a lot, because we don't have to care about all the specific details of the protein. Well, at this point, we have to check whether this model makes any sense and agrees with the experiment. So actually, fusion as self-assembly occurs not only in lipids, obviously, because lipids are just one kind of amphiphile that likes to self-assemble into two-dimensional membranes. You can use artificial polymers, which are very different from lipids because, well, they can be much longer. And so here you use water-soluble polymers which don't like each other, so they would repeat. So this is a diblock copolymer outlined here, and the blue segments don't like the black segments. So they self-assemble again into some phases, and if you add enough water, you can actually make very nice polymer zones. So these are analogs of liposomes, but made of these polymers. And Dennis Disher, who is going to be here, I guess, is going to talk about this stuff. So self-assembly is universal, and it's kind of expected from the physicist's point of view. Moreover, apparently fusion is also quite universal. So these are experimental pictures which actually show some kind of hints of the fusion intermediate. So you start from two vesicles, you end up with one vesicle. It's hard to see what's actually happening here. But it looks like in polymer zones, fusion can happen. So again, the assumption we're making is that self-assembly and fusion are universal processes, and we can model them with some simple approaches without relying on some specificity of proteins.
But in these polymer zones, don't you have large repulsive coverages over the
polymer? Yeah, well, they form exactly bilayers which look like that.
The blue there, I thought they were like repulsive polymers, right?
Yeah, so these are brushes that repel each other.
So how can they get close enough?
Well, that's a good question, and here they were doing it spontaneously. I don't remember what kind of solvent they used, but it spontaneously fused and actually spontaneously. This is fusion process.
Is it in water?
It's in water, but they probably added salt or something.
Yeah.
That I don't remember, but they didn't do anything special. They just said that we looked at the coarsening process. What they saw, that they started with a bunch of small vesicles, and at the end they saw small number of large vesicles, and they kind of said that the coarsening mechanism probably goes to the fusion, and that's what. But
yeah,
they never studied that process in detail.
That's in the history of fusion, it's all phenomenological, and some people
Exactly.
Then, you know,
well, we
that's what you're doing.
We're hoping to shed some light on it, and even though we assume that it's a very universal process, what you'll see at the end is that it relies on a very on fine tuning of parameters. Essentially, it will happen only in a very small range of parameters in a given model. So this is biologists' view on fusion process. We have two lipid membranes that they're trying to fuse, and you have to have fusion proteins. And these are some nice beasts, and I don't know much about them. I know that they can do some kind of gymnastics. If you add something like fuel or salt, they will change their conformation. And from the biologist's point of view, that's what probably drives the fusion process. But even in this picture, you can see that the fusion zone itself probably is lipid-rich, not the protein-rich. But this is a cartoon. Nobody has seen it in an experiment.
I guess I'm really coming to that, because if this is for the biology, appropriateness here, the vesicle that's fusion often contains a polymer, and there's an osmotic. There can be a huge osmotic effect here, bursting out, that's what the solution is. So there's more going on than just the liquid fusing. As soon as there's an exchange of solutions inside and outside, calcium, pH,
that's rarely the case. The osmotic force is important for this small amount of biological fusion. In many cases, you don't have any osmotic grains, many splains, or the seeds still get it.
Secretory granules, there are no polymer. Well,
secretion granules, not all of them, some of them indeed, clouds. But
sure.
If you have a look at the viral fusion, if you have a look at the
Yeah, that's what always happens when we have experimentalists in audience. Especially when you start talking about fusion, because it's pretty controversial. It's hard to do experiments on it, and when you do the experiments, it's hard to reproduce them, I guess, at some point. Anyway, the biologist's view is pretty complicated, pretty specific, and, well, it's hard to, well, if you show this to a model or to a physicist or whoever who tries to model this thing, it looks very complicated, and probably people wouldn't try to model this thing. And biologists even go further and say that, well, there are many different ways proteins can make the membranes fuse. They can make these barrel shapes. They can arrange into nice circles. They can make these guys, which change conformation. And the only thing they know that it starts off like that, and it ends up like this. So you start with unfused membranes. You end up with fused membranes. What happens here is a pure imagination. Because there is not much can be seen in experiments.
Have people done simulate just like I've seen a lot of molecular simulations where the noise would be important. I'm wondering if that's
noise. You mean just
thermal
effects. Yeah, sure. And well, we started working on this problem in 2001, and there were no molecular simulations when we started working on this. So I'm trying to give some kind of historical.
This guy, Humberla, he's doing simulations.
Yeah, 2002, and they didn't have any simulations at that time.
Now they have some.
Now there is probably a dozen group that are trying to do the simulations, and I'll talk about that. So, looks very complicated, very specific, non-universal, hard to model. Obviously, we're lazy. I forgot one of the speakers today already mentioned that. And, well, we're not just lazy, we're impatient, too. We want results fast, so we don't want to model something too complicated. So a physicist would say, okay, we know that experiments in pure liposomes also show fusion process, so let's assume that it's universal. So the fusion is driven purely by lipids. So presumably, the lipid fusion occurs in this way. You start with two bilayers in close contact, so that's just enlargement of this contact area between two liposomes. It makes some kind of interconnection, then this interconnection grows, and there is a radial symmetry, for simplicity again, and then it breaks down, and that's how you get the fusion pore. So now you go from two vesicles to one big vesicle, and it relaxes. And we're not interested in how it relaxes because it's so simple. So this is a physicist's point of view. Very nice and simple. Again, this is a pure speculation because nobody has seen it. This is the simplest possible thing you can think about how the fusion might occur. So there is a conceptual difficulty right away. First of all, we know that membranes are stable, and we've heard many talks today where where you do experiments and you manipulate membranes, you freeze them, you attach beads to them, and they still, they're intact, they don't rupture easily. And so they're very stable, and you have to apply pretty high tensions to break them, or you have to introduce some kind of defects to break them. So membranes are stable. On the other hand, for the fusion to occur, you have to go through topological change. You have to go from two membranes here to one membrane here. So at some point, for example, here you have to break a membrane. Why is it happening? So something, so the stability of membrane should be affected by the fact that we're making all these transformations during the fusion process. So this is a conceptual difficulty which actually has not been really directly addressed before. And well, we started thinking about it and we couldn't come up with a simple resolution of it. So, well, in the meantime, while we were thinking, we decided, why don't we do some modeling? So how do we do modeling? Well, we obviously can do ab initio. So we just take a lipid, we take force field, we put it on the computer, wait. Well, we can wait forever because even now, let alone in 2001, you cannot simulate large enough patches of membranes for long enough to see them fusing. Well, you can do phenological theory. That's the other end of the spectrum, which is the ultimately coarse-grained approach, where you assume that your membranes are essentially elastic sheets which have some elastic moduli, and you try to calculate bending free energy of these membranes while they fuse, and try to see what's the most optimal way of fusing them. Or you can be somewhere in between them, and we already heard some talks, and Marcus talked about coarse-grained simulations. You can do those and hope to get some information. And there is a bunch of different approaches, from standard MD in Monte Carlo to dynamic density functional theories, dissipative particle dynamics, and there are many different approaches, and as you will see, even though they rely on different approximations, and they all kind of converge on the same result, which is nice. So, historically, this was the first approach that has been used to explain the fusion process, and obviously that sounds to be like the easiest possible approach to play with. So, back in 1983, Kozlov and Markin in Russia modeled membranes, not just, so they modeled one membrane, not just the one elastic sheet, but it's a coupled pair of two elastic sheets. So each monolayer of the membrane is a separate elastic surface. And now you can try to come up with some reasonable shapes of membrane fusion intermediates, which look like, you start from two membranes which don't have any interconnection, so these would be just two flat membranes in contact. And then you try to calculate what's the energy cost to bend them in such a way that they make this interconnection. And then you try to see how much cost do you have to pay to enlarge this interconnection, just radially expand it, and then how much does it cost to make the fusion work at the end. And you just use Helfrich Hamiltonian. You immediately see that you get into trouble because whenever you have situation that essentially three membranes are meeting, you have these interstitial volumes which you cannot eliminate by smoothly bending membranes. You either have to break the curvature here, or you have to introduce an extra term that describes this volume effect. So
you don't have tails. You don't actually have lipids.
No, this is purely phenomenological.
You're just bending these things.
You just assume a shape, or you optimize the shape of these elastic sheets, these black lines, and you calculate the bending energy.
But that's dangerous, just for the same reason that Mark said before. As soon as you get these things close together, the area per head starts change. Everything changes.
Yes. So, well, that's the easiest.
It seems to me getting to B is the problem. That's what you want to get. Once you're at B, you're pretty much done.
No, that's not true. They're not fused. This is what's called hemifusion state. There is no connectivity between one compartment and the other compartment. You still have to do some work to go from here to there, probably, and to there. You don't know how, but...
That's a lot easier than getting to B.
Well, as you will see, it's not. Getting that is easy. The most free energy you have to pay is actually after you form this initial stock. This is what's called a stock. Well, it looks like a small stock. So very nice, very simple. Some of the work can be done purely analytically. You can write down the closed form expression, plug in numbers from experiment, and you get numbers for the fusion barriers, how much free energy you have to pay to fuse the things. And here's the energy crisis. So the first, it's not about the American economy, it's about fusion energy crisis. So if you just plug in numbers into the simplest model, you find that the free energy barrier is on the order of hundreds of KT. And this is very unreasonable. According to experimental estimates, the largest free energy barrier that can be accommodated on relevant time scales is about 40 KT. So, well, you can play around with this model more, you can refine it, you can introduce tilt, you can replace these interstitial areas with these tilted configurations. You can introduce more parameters, and you can lower free energy barrier down to 40 KT or even negative values. So, can I just finish this? So, you can get reasonable values, but the worrisome thing is that, well, in principle, you can get any number you want. Because this model, you can keep refining it, or you can just play around with the parameters, and you can get any number. So it's hardly, in our opinion, it didn't have much of predicting power, and so we decided to look at something else. And you had a question?
Yeah, well, Julia, can you come back to your stock and infusion?
Yeah.
I know it's all out of scale, but what kind of bending energies are we paying when you make those kind of very, very sharp curvatures?
You will see those results, but in the lipid systems that fuse, you pay about 10 to 20 KT to get these structures, per structure. That's roughly.
Why the membrane would like to bend that much?
Hmm?
I'm just wondering why the membrane would like to bend that much to play that. I mean, the curvature becomes appreciably small.
Well, it's an excited process, so you have initial state, and you have a lower final state. So, well, it will try many times to fuse. It will fail many times, but when it fuses, it will go down to the lower free energy. So we're trying to estimate this time. We're trying to find out how does it look.
We include the energy costs that make us horrible shock curvature.
Yeah, so this is what these people did. They calculated this bending free energy, and you can get numbers all over the place. And it's a very nice model. I mean, it gives you qualitative insight that if you, let's say, change the spontaneous curvature of each monolayer, how it will affect the fusion process, but hardly gives you quantitative insight in the model. So, and moreover, it assumes the fusion mechanisms. It assumes that the fusion has to go through the radially symmetric intermediates. So everything is radially symmetric in this calculation. As soon as you go off radial symmetry, it's hard, and nobody has done it. So we decided, while we were thinking about the fusion mechanisms, that we can run some simulation and hopefully see the standard fusion mechanism, and at least have some kind of computer experiment supporting it. Again, we knew something about polymers. Each of us worked in polymer physics for some time. And Marcus Muller, he's an expert in computer simulations, especially in polymer systems. So he essentially modified his old program that was simulating simple polymers and self-assembly and diblocker polymers or with solvent into the one where we had two membranes in close contact under some lateral tension, and he just let it run for some time, actually a few days, that was long enough. So the model is this. This is a completely opposite from Marcus's model, where he had three beads, so he would have just this thing. So blue beads don't like red beads, but so it doesn't look exactly like a lipid, but again, we assume universality, so as long as it's an amphiphile that likes to form bilayer-like structure, we assume that this is enough for the fusion process to occur. And if fusion occurs, it will probably occur in the same way as in almost any other model of the amphiphile. So that was the assumption, and we run many, many, many different simulations of this, and on order of 100 to get good statistics at different parameters. And when we looked at the results, we realized that we don't understand what's going on. So in the beginning, we saw formation of the stock. So what's shown here is only the hydrophobic inside of each bilayer. So these are two membranes, and red is just hydrophobic tails, and heads are not shown. And whenever, so these are cuts in the plane which are parallel to the membrane. So whenever some kind of interconnection is formed, you'll see a red structure. So this is our initial radial stop. So you can see that at the initial stages, after some time when the membranes kind of equilibrate, fluctuate, bounce against each other, they do form these stops. This is completely spontaneous, and again, it's an activated process, so you have to wait.
Less than 1 kBT, then, that
means. Less than 1?
The barrier is less than 1 kBT, so because...
Oh, no. This can be larger than 1 kBT, much larger than 1 kBT. So you have to wait pretty long time to see this. But it does form, and it stays there. It can get destroyed. I mean, it can just get broken up and go back to the two disconnected membranes. You can form two of these or three of them in the simulation cell. But then what happens, it was a complete mystery, and when we looked at it, it looked like a complete disorder. We didn't understand what's going on. Because in what we expected, that this red dot will just grow radially, just enlarge, and then there will be a hole in between, and that's the end of it. That's the fusion, the standard fusion mechanism. No, we didn't see that. We saw that this red dot started to form worm-like extended objects instead of radially symmetric objects. And right after it would kind of enlarge in size, the membrane will become unstable. It would rupture spontaneously. It wouldn't rupture in the way that it will just destroy the whole membrane and, it wouldn't irreversibly rupture. It will make these small holes right next to this original defect, the elongated stop. So we were very puzzled, and you can see here another view of this defect. So there is now a connection between inside of one vesicle, essentially, and the outside. So we looked at many different simulation runs, and all of them shown very similar features. And we didn't see, we saw a couple out of maybe 100 that went through the standard fusion mechanism. Most of them went through this alternative one. So just to summarize, these are the cartoons of what we saw. So the standard mechanism would do this. So you start from two bilayers, make initial stock spontaneously. This initial stock might end up in more enlarged diaphragm, which might enlarge and make what's called chemifusion diaphragm, which would then ruptures and makes fusion pore. So this is the standard hypothesis for the so-called stock mechanism of fusion. What we saw that you do form initial stock, but then the stock elongates. Instead of just radially expanding, it elongates, and then you rupture either one of the membranes or both of the membranes next to this form defect, and then they somehow seal this ruptured region and you form a fusion pore.
Can you see the last stage?
This one?
From there to there.
From here to there? Yeah. And I do have pictures of the final fusion pore. It looks nice, toroidal like. We do have that kind of analysis, but essentially we saw more or less half of the fusion processes going this way or that way.
So, but in nature, basically, that fusion.
In nature?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I'm not yet comparing to the nature because you'll understand why. Because at this point, we were very happy because we thought we found something new and exciting, and probably nobody even expected that, and we tried to obviously talk to experimental people, and
can you just say something about the Monte Carlo that you're running? I mean, there is fancy groups.
No, this is standard so-called bond fluctuation model on a lattice.
So, okay,
and we did use slither and snake moves, but they're all local moves.
So I'm not familiar with the terminology.
This is on a lattice. This is a lattice Monte Carlo, but it's a bond fluctuation model, so you have many kinds of bonds. It's like 18 centimeters, but types of bonds. So it very much looks like a continuum model. So when we were trying to sell our theory to experimentalists, we were greeted with with some bad words saying that no, your model was wrong. You probably have not. It probably has nothing to do with real fusion. First of all, you don't have peptides. Second, you don't. Your lipids are not lipids at all, and I mean they look much worse than Marcus's lipids because they don't even have the right ratio. So just forget about it. And moreover, people were not happy with the fact that this thing predicts so-called leakage. You can see that in the standard mechanism, the up and down, or so insides of both vesicles are never connected to the outside. So there's never a connection between this part and the outside. And the only connection that forms after the fusion between two vesicles. Whereas in this alternative mechanism, you can see that on the first stage, actually already formed this connection to the outside, and that's leakage. So whenever fusion will occur, we predict that some stuff will leak out or will leak into the vesicle. And that's bad. And the standard explanation for that was that, from biologists, that nature is smart enough to make things non-leaky. So why would it do something so inefficient in leaking? So, well, we didn't have anything to...
How much that actually leaks would depend on how long the distance is. So
yeah, that's a very good point. It's a transient leakage. And it, moreover, these holes are not large enough to leak some important stuff, like DNA will not be able to squeeze in, because these are nanometer size holes. These are not ruptured holes. So, but those were all details, and in large, biological community, well, at that time, wasn't very happy with this. And we were lucky enough to be invited to a conference in Moscow where the original theorists were present who worked out the first model, the stock model, and we were greeted with even more bad words about our model. But we were lucky enough to meet experimentalists who actually said, well, maybe your model is not complete nonsense because we have experiments that actually probably support it. And the experiment is intuitively very simple. So As I told you, the only obvious thing that is different between the two mechanisms is that there is leakage. Okay? Can you see this leakage? Well, you ask a biologist and they would say yes, you do see leakage in almost any fusion experiment, but it's unrelated to fusion. So that's the standard dogma that even if leakage occurs, it probably because of something else. The peptides may be rupturing membranes, or maybe there's too much tension and that ruptures membrane. It's never attributed to fusion process. So, but if you're smart and if you can design an experiment that actually proves the fact that leakage is correlated in time and space with the fusion process, then you can say that, well, the standard mechanism cannot explain the leakage, so it must be wrong, at least for this particular experiment. And that's exactly the experiment that has been done by Vadim Frolov, who is here in the audience, and his group, where what they've done, this is so-called double patch clamp experiment, where you measure conductance or capacitance through the membranes. And essentially, you can measure currents in between two membranes, so that would be the fusion current, and you can measure the leakage current. So the standard mechanism would predict that you should have increase in the fusion current, so this is this curve, so the fusion current should go from zero when there is no fusion pore present to something very large when the fusion pore is present and is enlarging. But the leakage current should stay zero. So these are two leakage currents, one vesicle one and vesicle two, or cells in that experiment. But that's not what's seen in the experiment. In many experimental runs, you would see this, that the leakage current would actually rise right before the fusion current would increase immensely. So this was kind of proof of the point that leakage is correlated with the fusion, because in this experiment, you are not measuring many fusion events. You are measuring just one fusion event. So even though you cannot see it, but you can feel the current, because you can do very fine measurements of the current. So you see one fusion event, and you can see one leakage event. And, well, rarely they would happen at the same time. I mean, if they happen at the same time, that means they're probably related. So that was kind of a proof that leakage occurs in connection with fusion. And these are simulation results which look qualitatively similar to experimental results. So these are leakage currents in our simulations, this is fusion current. But
could I ask you this between cell membranes or vascular membranes?
These are cells. These are fat cells.
With lots of proteins present.
Lots of proteins present. Yeah. But we said that they go away magically. We don't know why, but we have to rely on that.
But membranes are breaking?
Hmm?
So both cells are leaking?
In this experiment, yeah. So you can see that both membranes are leaking. So this would correspond to this process when you make calls in both. And in some experiments, I believe one of the vesicle or cell would leak, not that one. So this is just one of the answers. Well, so we were happy, and we became even more happy when people started to do porous grain simulations. And these are all the different ones I mentioned, different types of MD porous grain model or Brownian dynamics of stiff trimers, which has, I mean, looks like a lipid, but it's not really a lipid, or DPD of these kind of molecules, which mimic lipids. And in almost exclusively in all these simulations, what people saw is this alternative mechanism. And if you look closely at these results, you will see that this initial interconnection, again, the stalk, it kind of elongates first, makes a hole. So the point is that we are not claiming that this alternative mechanism is the only mechanism that's present, but it's a physical mechanism. It can happen. Something else beyond the standard mechanism can happen. And since it's so universal, and I mean, it's observed in many different models, it's probably not a fluke of modeling. It's probably real. Now, we have experiments that support this alternative mechanism. We have computer experiments that support this alternative mechanism, but we still don't have a real explanation. Why there is no radial stalk expansion, which is so natural and so easy to understand? Why bilayer becomes unstable? Why these transient holes form, even though the isolated bilayer is so stable? In our simulations, if you just have one bilayer without contact with another one, it would just stay for a very, very, very long time without rupturing. So why this happens? So what we need to do, we really need to calculate free energies of different intermediates and try to optimize the intermediates and try to compare them and find which of the mechanisms wins, whether it's the standard mechanism or non-standard mechanism. And doing this in simulations, it's really hard to get the free energy. And I'm not really a person who does big scale simulations, but it's my understanding that if you want to just get structures, it's hard. But if you want to get free energies, it's 10 times as hard because, well, you have to have statistics. You have to have many runs to get the entropy part. You can get the energy part easily. It's just the sum of the energies. But the entropy part requires averaging over a configuration. So that's very hard in simulations. But, well, we were lucky enough, we were probably lazy enough from the beginning that we chose a very simple model to start with. So we can map this model on the so-called field theory, self-consistent field theory approach, and we can actually make one-to-one mapping of this, of the thread model we used in our simulations to a Gaussian thread model in the self-consistent field theory. So now we simplify our lipids even more. So now there are these kind of threads which are infinitely thin but have finite volume. I mean, they kind of occupy space. Segments, red and blue segments, don't like each other. So it's exactly like in our simulations. It's just we don't have beads anymore. We have essentially threads. But they still self-assemble into this layered structure. So they make cylinders. So this would be a hexagonal phase. So they do the same things as normal amphiphiles would do, as the lipids would do. But the nice thing about this field theory is that it allows us to get not only density profiles of different segments in space, but also free energies. And it can be extended to many different architectures of lipids, adding solvent charges, anything you can think of. And it's simple enough that it's easy to solve on a computer, relatively easy to solve on a computer. So we can get intermediates. These are the metastable configurations on the way of the fusion process. We can get transition states if we're using reaction coordinate constraints. And I'll talk about it a little bit later. So this is my theory slide. I don't have time to go through the equations. They're simple. They're not hard. And what you have to do, you have to find a smart way of solving them. These are nonlinear equations, but well, there are more or less standard ways of solving them to get, so you start from some kind of Hamiltonian and you end up with getting the free energy. So that's the result, and densities. And just to give you a feel what it is, kind of intuitively, you start off from a bunch of molecules that interact with each other. And this is an extremely hard problem because you're trying to do statistical physics, so you're trying to calculate partition function of a many chain problem. In this case, this is simple melt of two polymers, for example. And you definitely cannot do this, but what you do, you transform your problem in, using Hubbard-Stoltonius transformation into a field-based language. So now, instead of many molecules interacting with each other, you have just one molecule interacting with some kind of external field, which is chosen self-consistently, and you iterate to the consistency. This can be done easily. Now, about the reaction coordinate constraint. As I have shown you, for example, if we assume the standard stock mechanism, we have to study different size stocks, fusion pores, just to try to get the free energy of those structures. So somehow we should be able to constrain the overall size and topology of the system. And here I just give you, I guess many people have this part in their quantum chemistry or quantum physics class a few years ago, many years ago, for some of us. So it's very similar to Born-Oppenheimer approximation. So in the Born-Oppenheimer approximation, you assume that your nuclei are essentially fixed because they're so fat, they cannot move fast, whereas electrons are moving very quickly. So in our approach, we say, okay, the overall shape is fixed. Even though the lipids can move fast enough and equilibrate on a very short time scale, the overall shape is fixed. And as we, let's say, increase the radius of this structure, we're trying to pull it apart, we give it enough time so that the lipids can rearrange on locally, but not globally. So the analog of electronic ground state would be the lowest free energy state in the system for given parameter set. And internuclear distance would correspond to the structure size. For example, if the stock is expanding radially, then the structure size, we define it as just the width of this neck, so just this radius. And we can change it continuously and calculate free energy as a function of this radius, for example. And the same can be done with fusion pore and other structures. So this is an example of the outcome of our calculations, and I will just go through quickly through this. But so we can, so these are density profiles. So they're actually smooth, and what's plotted here is kind of contour plot. So the dark gray area shows the majority of the head groups. So the density of head groups is high in the dark gray area. Light gray is the majority of tail segments, and white is the solvent. So you can see this, that we clearly have two membranes which are in contact and making interconnection. And this particular interconnection corresponds to about this state, just forming. And then we can increase its radius, and we can calculate not only the density shapes, but we can also get the free energy profiles. Yes?
Is this a 2D simulation?
Good question. Again, we're lazy and impatient, so here we assume radial symmetry.
Then you'll never get what you got before then.
Well, just wait. We're not that lazy.
Okay.
So first we wanted to look at the standard mechanism. Okay?
What's F?
Yeah, sorry. So F is the architectural parameter, and that corresponds to the, I forgot to mention it, that corresponds to the fraction of the heads versus the total number of segments. So F of 0.5 would correspond that volume of the head group is the same as volume of the tail group. And obviously in real lipids, its head group is a bit smaller than the tail region in terms of volume. So that's why you see numbers smaller than half here. So you can see that, for example, formation of the stock, this kind of initial interconnection, doesn't cost you much. Well, it can cost you up to 10 kT, but you can see that free energy curves go much higher after that. So as you try to increase the size of this structure, you have to pay lots of free energy. And as you decrease the head size, so you're getting closer to inverted hexagonal forming lipids, this would correspond to DOPE, for example, you do see that you can lower free energies a lot. But still, I mean, in the reasonable range of the head sizes, the free energy, the major cost of the free energy is not associated with the formation of the stock.
What's chi n here?
Cayenne 25. So cayenne corresponds to the strength of the interaction, and 25 means that it's kind of intermediate strength. That's for the polymer people that are present here. Now, this
it's like a strongly segregated system.
It's intermediate segregation. So it just to give you an idea, the critical cayenne at which this system doesn't segregate is about 10 or 11. So you're twice as large. But it's not super strongly segregated. It's strongly segregated that in the sense that the interfaces are pretty sharp.
Yeah.
They're not, they're diffuse, but I mean the width of the interface is probably going to be this much. But they're well separated. Now there's on this graph I show dependence of free energy on the applied membrane tension, and membrane tension is applied through the chemical potential of the amplifier. So as you decrease chemical potential of the amplifier, so essentially take them out, so you're applying effectively, you can show that you're applying the lateral tension to the membranes. And obviously, membranes would be much happier to eliminate the area, their area, because then they eliminate this tension. So at very large radii, when you go from two membranes to one membrane in between here, you obviously get this R squared turnover. And that's kind of corresponds to the standard deviation theory if you play with it. So as you increase tension, definitely you promote fusion. The fusion barrier goes down. And that's in agreement with the experiment. Now we also looked at this final fusion pore, what's the free energy of it. And again, you find the solution which looks like fusion pore, and then you try to study free energy dependence of this structure on its radius. And radius is defined again from the middle to this interface. And what this is what you get. So dashed lines are the expansion of the stock free energy, and the full lines are corresponding fusion pore free energy. And you see that fusion pore free energy looks quite interesting because it has this local minimum, which, well, if one have thought about it from the beginning, probably one could have guessed that as you decrease the size of the pore, these leaves are going to push against each other, so free energy will probably go up. But we were very happy kind of to see this without putting it in any kind of phenomenological approach, that it comes out from our calculations. And actually, these guys have been seen experimentally. So experimentally, what you would see is that you can form a fusion pore because it has a lower free energy than the stock. So the stock will convert into the fusion pore probably. But then this fusion pore will sit there and it will not expand. It will just sit there and probably you can measure some conductance, but it will not expand. It can actually close up again and go back to the intact membranes. But if you apply enough tension, and here's the tension, actually you don't need to apply lots of tension. You convert these metastable pores to unstable structures which just run away to infinity. They just increase and
so
without any limit.
0.1,
that's roughly the largest tension. Well, I would say 0.2 roughly is the largest tension liposomes can sustain.
So in terms of rupture tension, that's...
So this would be rupture tension for the membrane. Oh, in the experiment time scale. Again, membrane is always unstable under any... So if you just take one membrane, it is always unstable under any tension, because no matter how small is the tension, eventually it will turn over. But depending on this height, it will just tell us how much you have to weigh.
Sorry, why does two membranes have to contact so tightly? I mean, why's they have the heavy stock?
Yeah.
And why they still have to touch so tightly?
You mean why they're not separated
exactly.
Here?
Then
there's
maybe more expensive with the free energy, right? At that time, because you make some edge over there. So
well,
here? Yeah, exactly.
Well, this is periodic, well, kind of periodic boundary condition. It's radial symmetry. Actually, it's a no flux boundary condition at this side. So the only reason why the membranes are still in contact here is that there is very small attraction between membranes, which is caused by the solvent.
I just want to know if really having an experiment or in nature, how about that?
Well, normally, my understanding is that what the fusion proteins, for example, do, or let's say calcium, in the calcium-induced fusion, is that membranes are held together by proteins, for example, or by calcium bridges. Okay? So I might be wrong, but in any fusion event, first you have to bring membranes together and you have to let them sit there for quite a long time before the fusion occurs. So there should be a mechanism that keeps them in close contact. And in our case, it's a very small attraction between membranes, which doesn't contribute to the free energy a lot. It's much less than KT. But it keeps them together.
But then they have to fluctuate.
We don't have fluctuations. It's a mean field. Yeah.
Yes.
In principle, we can, yeah. We haven't played around with that. But I don't think we'll, I mean, it will affect the fusion mechanism, obviously, but no, we haven't played around with it. Everything is symmetric. Again, we're kind of lazy, so when you have some symmetry, you're trying to exploit it. And we did it here. So, for example, calculations are really done in this quadrant only. Everything is up, down, symmetric.
Since you have a mixture here of polymers, did you check what happened with the osmotic pressure?
Well, there is not really osmotic pressure because...
It would be the variation of your free energy versus the fraction of polymers in the layer, for example.
There are two types of polymers here. One which comprises the membranes, and that's a dipole. So it has A and B segments. And there is another polymer which mimics the solvent. That's made of hydrophilic segments only. So there is no osmotic pressure in the normal sense. There is no small solvent and large polymer floating around that can put osmotic stress on it. So this is single solvent, essentially. So we can get, I'll be running through these results, we can get lots of information. And again, the major consequences of this work is that the major barrier is not associated with the formation of the stock. Formation of the stock is easy, at least in our model. And this actually has been a long-standing question, and many theories actually predict that this original barrier is very large and at least comparable with the other barriers. So we kind of show that it's probably not true. Second consequence is that fusion is very regulated or limited in terms of the parameter space. So here I plot a kind of a phase diagram. So on the x-axis is the head size, so in this direction. So 0.5 would correspond to a symmetric case where head and tail is the same volume size. And going in this direction, we're kind of going towards formation of the inverted hexagonal phase. So lipids for these Fs, so DOPC would correspond to roughly this point on the phase diagram, this line, and DOPE would be here. So DOPE already forms inverted hexagonal in equilibrium. So what we show is that fusion can occur only in a very small part of this phase space. If you're to the right of this fusion zone, you don't form metastable stocks anymore. So your free energy curve, instead of making this kind of local minimum, just goes up without minimum. So it kind of tells you that the system will have to go from here to there instead of from here to there first, and then kind of topologically it already looks like the right thing. So we kind of assume that there will be no fusion in this zone. And to the left, instead of fusion, you will see spontaneous conversion of the membranes into inverted hexagonal-like structures. So you'll just make rolls of lipids, which will destabilize membrane and probably just destroy the liposomes. And well, if you go point to the left, then you cannot make the liposomes at all. Now, I also show here that you can have so-called flickering pores, which I mentioned. These are metastable fusion pores which don't enlarge for quite a long time. Or you can have expanding pores, and this is regulated purely by the tension of the membranes. Moreover, you can find the so-called stock phase, where you form these small radial structures which are arranged on the lattice. And these have been observed in experiment. And so we're also happy to confirm that. Now, about the alternative mechanism, I have only 3 minutes left for that. it's hard to do three-dimensional calculations, even though the model is simple relatively. But what we did, we said, okay, if you look at the intermediate, let's say this one, the topology like this, you can see obviously that this looks like a fusion core part, this looks like two edges, two bare edges of the membrane. So our assumption was that we can probably use results of our axially symmetric intermediates and make linear combinations of them and approximate free energy of this structure just by mixing of free energy of a fraction of that and fraction of this, for example. And we can play around with essentially all of our intermediates which we saw in the simulations. Now the question is, there's something must have happened when we go from this kind of intermediate to that kind of intermediate. There has to be a transition zone. And we tried to estimate it, and it actually it looks to be that the free energy corresponding to that intermediate zone has a negative free energy. So, and it's only a couple of kT, not more than that, so we can show that. So this defect, which occurs when you go from the left part to the right-hand side, is small and you can neglect it, and actually we played around with that defect free energy and doesn't change the qualitative results. So now instead of just one reaction coordinate, which is the size of the structure, you have another coordinate, which is a fraction of one of the structure versus another structure. So instead of just R, you have alpha, and you can come up with a simple way of combining different structures, and what you get at the end is free energy maps, and you start off on this line somewhere. So you start with alpha zero, which corresponds to unfused membranes, and then you have to traverse this free energy landscape somehow and end up at very large R for the fusion core of large size. So what you have to do, you have to look at the landscape and find the minimal free energy pathway, the saddle point. And we can do that, and we can summarize it in a free energy barrier. So on the right-hand side, this is the standard mechanism, the old mechanism free energy barrier is a function of lipid architecture and tension, and this is for the new mechanism. And they look roughly the same. You can see more sensitivity on the parameters for the new mechanism, but the numbers are more or less on the same order. Now you can just subtract one from the other, and you can see that at least for our model, the new alternative mechanism always wins, so the free energy of the old mechanism is always higher, and these are the numbers by how much it is higher. It's not, I mean, the difference is not that large. For example, one kT is nothing, so even though the exponential factor, so we assume that the rate is proportional to the free energy barrier over kT, so when this is order one, one kT difference, this is very small, I mean, not very large factor, so there will be kinetic prefactor here, which we don't know. So what we can say is that both mechanisms are actually feasible, and depending on the fine features of the system, you'll probably be able to see both of them. Moreover, we saw that even though in the alternative mechanism the membranes are ruptured locally, the leakage can vary a lot because, well, this alpha parameter, which corresponds to by how much you expose the free edge of the membrane, can be either close to zero to one, and that corresponds to either very leaky or very non-leaky fusion. So again, just looking at these points on the free energy landscapes, and just looking, figuring out how large is the alpha and R, we can tell that depending on the thermodynamic parameters, F and gamma, the fusion can be either very leaky or non-leaky, and that was a nice prediction because in experiments you sometimes see leaky fusion, sometimes you don't see leaky fusion, so this phase diagram kind of predicts both, and it actually predicts how you can make your fusion less leaky by changing the lipids or tension, for example. And well, again, to give you a kind of simple idea why the membrane breaks very close to the initial stock, this is kind of very hand-waving argument after the fact, after you know the answer. It's very easy to make hand-waving arguments. So imagine that you're trying to make a hole in the membrane very far away from any defect. So here are the two membranes, you're trying to rupture one of the membranes. And to go over the critical size, so if you just use simple negation theory, you'll have to pay some linear free energy corresponding to the line tension of the hole, and you'll be getting some, getting rid of some tension. So that's the quadratic part. So you can get what's the free energy cost to form this critical hole, and you can calculate then the probability of forming it just by taking the exponent of that. And now you can compare it to the hole formed right next to some defect. So here you can see that the line tension is modified. So instead of having the bare edge of the membrane, now some part of this bare edge is replaced with this kind of structure. It looks like trilaminar junction, for example, in this case. So what you can, again, assume that you can make some kind of linear combination of bare edge and this modified intermediate. You can plug it in, and what you get is that under simulation conditions, probability to find hole next to the defect versus away from the defect is about order of magnitude larger, and experimental conditions are much harsher, and in that case, there is four orders of magnitude increase in probability to rupture membrane right next to the defect, which is very nice.
Can Boffin say it's easier to form a hole close to where it's entering the structure?
You can put it that way, exactly. But sometimes, so this essentially tells you that hole and the stock attract each other. Doesn't have to be the only outcome, but in this case it is. So just to conclude, we still don't know what is really going on in biological fusion, because this is simply a toy model, but hopefully it kind of at least sheds light on some aspects of the fusion process. Real membranes are multi-component systems, and we have just one component. We played around with lipid mixtures, but I mean, it changes things quantitatively. We didn't see any qualitative changes. We haven't played around with cholesterol, which is known to be important player. Real membranes are non-symmetric. The up and down of the membrane frequently is very, very different. We haven't played around with that. We have ways of doing that too, but it has to be checked. How important is this asymmetry? External constraints, vesicle size, because if you have small synaptic vesicle, the fact that the volume has to be preserved can be a very important constraint. Haven't done that. We don't know what the fusion peptides do, and that would be very interesting to see whether one can use either coarse grain model or this kind of field theory model to describe that real process. And we definitely need more fine experiments that can see the fusion. And I would like to thank all our friends in biology and physics who are listening to us, and most of the thanks to Vadim Frolov, who is here, who actually kept us alive, because we were essentially going down. We started to disbelieve our results too after talking for some time, trying to explain our model to some people. But he supported us, and he published his experiments next to our paper, so it made our paper much more believable. And the work has been supported by different German and American grants, and yeah, this is it. Thank you.